You're listening to your community radio station. It's KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Molawa'a, K284AL Hala'iva. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. I'm your host, Paul Massey, director of Regeneration's Botanical Garden. And on today's show, we'll satiate our desire for tropical fruits, both familiar and exotic, with the extraordinary Ken Love, and infuse our awareness of one of the most beloved herbal teas on the planet. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and More, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and More features Honda Garden and Lawn Equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
The Kauai store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostulas. The store has authentic Kauai products including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
And thank you so much to those wonderful underwriters for bringing what they bring to the Garden Island. And to all of you, put your hands in the soil and make it happen. It's super great to stand side by side with you and dream into what this beautiful Garden Island can be. We want to thank as well David Kuhn for the beautiful sounds of the native Hawaiian forest up in Koke'e. Some of the rarest birds on the planet live there. And David's work can be found at soundshawaiian.com, where he gathers, archives, and shares the ancient natural voices of the Aina here and deepens in our relationship with them. And it's a great website to check out. I enjoyed, certainly. And he's got some little clips, too, of some of maybe the more familiar birds we know here on the Hawaiian Islands. And we often hear these birds singing, but we don't perhaps know whose voice we're listening to. So I just wanted to take a moment to play a couple of his recordings that he's made. He's just got some brief recordings of some of the more common birds. And so you probably know this one right here. This is the red-crested cardinal. Here. A very common voice here on Kauai. Let's have a look, listen as well to the house finch. Yes, very, very familiar sounds. I think it's going to take me a while to learn them all, but thank you, David Kuhn, for illuminating those voices for us and so many more. We've got a great show planned for you today, talking to Ken Lowe from the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Association. And a wonderful contribution he sure makes to our community in all the exotic fruits he brings to light. First, we're going to start with our celestial session, a look to the heavenly skies above for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming activities. Today's Hawaiian moon, La'au Kukahi, and this is in the Poi Poi, still in that sort of full moon phase. La'au Kukahi will rise over Kauai at 9:55 p.m. tonight. She'll reach her transit or highest point in the sky at 4:08 a.m. tomorrow morning, and she'll set at 10:18 tomorrow morning, Thursday. 79% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated. And we have the last quarter moon coming up on the last day of the month, which is this Sunday at 5:28 p.m. La'au Kukahi is the first of the La'au moons, good for planting mai'a, bananas, ulu, breadfruit, and other trees. It is also a moon recommended for harvesting plants to be used as medicine. Now looking at the biodynamic look at things brought to us by Heaven on Earth Starts, we are in the descending moon phase, which means it's planting time, so that lines up really nice with the Hawaiian moon today. The moon is in Leo today, which is a fire sign, making it a good day to work with our fruiting plants. Robin recommends that we plant fruit-bearing trees. So let's remember that's the mai'a and the ulu especially, but all fruit-bearing trees are great to be planted today, as well as peas and squash. Then Thursday and Friday of this week, the moon enters the constellation of Virgo, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants, beets, radish, carrots, and Robin has made a special recommendation of onions. It is time to get our short season onions in for bulbs, and so hopefully you've got some starts ready to put those in, or maybe you could get your hands on some, but that surely is a treat, Hawaiian grown onions. Saturday and Sunday, the moon is in Libra, an air sign. This is a good time to work with our flowering plants over the weekend. And Robin recommends calendula as well as tropicals. I know I don't have enough tropical flowers. Whenever there's a pa'ina or some other special event, I'm always casting about for where those hardy tropical flowers might be found. We've got, of course, a lot of great commercial growers here on the island, but not a bad idea for us to get a few more of the diversity of the heliconias and other tropical flowers in the ground. I sure would like to. Then Monday and Tuesday of this coming week, the moon will enter the constellation of Scorpio, which is a water sign. And this is a good time to work with our leaf plants. We can still get in a late crop of romaine and butter lettuce, and of course kales and the chards too, as long as we don't have too many fungal problems on that chard in the wintertime. So thanks so much, Robin, for our biodynamic look at things. And now we're going to have a look at some notable news that's interesting to us growers. And I do have a look there at the CTAR, or the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture, for some news from them. And a news article that came out on the 5th of January was just to announce that CTAR represented Hawaii at a symposium in Manila, in the Philippines, entitled Moringa oleifera, A Decade of Advances in Research and Development. This is our beloved marungai, or malungai, kalamungai plant, originally from India, widely adopted, deeply adopted by Filipino growers, and now the rest of us are learning the many nutritional benefits of this plant. At any rate, this symposium happened on November 15th to 18th of last year, first international symposium on the important multipurpose tree, brought together 300 scientists from the international community. Oh, it would have been so fun. But we had some great representatives, friends of the program and of all us growers here on Kauai and through the Hawaiian Islands. Ted Radovich of the organic program at CTAR, Russell Nagata, and John McHugh, Glenn Tevies, Amjad Ahmad, and Robert Paul, all from UHCTAR, gave an invited talk, Germplasm Evaluation and Selection of Moringa oleifera in Hawaii, which is certainly exciting that that's where the research has been going. This is a plant that is often grown from seed, but there are cultivars, and depending on what part of the plant you might be interested in using the most, there are ones I think I understand that are better for leaf and pod production. There were over 100 presentations focusing on the horticultural processing and use of the tree. CTAR recommends if you don't have one, consider planting one of these trees. They certainly are useful and very valuable crop coming up soon. So really glad that CTAR is helping to lead us forward in that direction. Another piece of notable news to share today, thanks to Ray Maki of the Hawaii Farmers Union. He sent out a link to us, very detailed, good information on how the new Food Safety Modernization Act rule for produce farms is going to affect the small producer. Probably the easiest way to find this article is to do an internet search for Sustainable Agriculture Produce Rule. When I did that, the article in question was the second one that came up in the list. And this is from sustainableagriculture.net. So really important for us to know how this is going to affect our production and, you know, staying in the regulations coming up. And it's hopefully not going to be too much of a burden to producers, but the more educated we get, the better. I know there was a meeting on Kauai and throughout the Hawaiian Islands held last week, but I heard a little bit that it was not as comprehensive or knowledgeable as it could have been. This article certainly seems to have the small producer in mind from the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. So definitely through the lens that we could understand well, us who like to tend the land with agroecology in mind. So thank you, Ray, for that. And that's our notable news for today. This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. And I'm your host, Paul. And I am so happy to share my passion of plants today. And there's one that's been in my mind for a long time, thinking about why in the world do we not see this plant being grown on a more regular basis here in Hawaii, as we see plants from around the world adapted to subtropical or tropical conditions thriving here. What's going on? So the plant I'm going to talk about today with you is yerba mate, is what it's known as in its consumable form. This is a member of the holly family, and its botanical name, Ilex paraguariensis, and commonly known as mate, and very popular tea plant here in terms of getting it off the shelf, but we're not seeing so much of it growing yet. It is a dioecious, which means separate male and female plants, white-flowered evergreen tree, can grow up to 60 feet tall. Of course, if it's managed in a tea plantation, it can be kept much shorter than that. It's found in the wild near streams in moist, well-drained soil in the sun or the shade. The native range includes parts of Paraguay, Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina. And mate's highest popularity as a tea is in Uruguay and Argentina, although it has become popular around the world, apparently very popular in the Middle East, in Syria, and other places, and has become very popular in the U.S. over the past 25 years, probably. Brazil is the largest producer of mate in the world. In Hawaii, it is listed as cultivated and sparingly naturalized in the mesic valleys, which means moist, not wet forest, not dry forest, but somewhere in the middle, at least in Manoa and Waiahole valleys on Oahu. And I had a look at a map. These valleys are not right next to each other, so it looks like two separate cultivation efforts resulted in some very sparingly naturalization of this plant. I've also heard that it is invasive in Manoa, but I couldn't really find anything to bear that out for sure. It was first collected on Oahu in 1934, probably by the Bishop Museum or affiliated botanists. So it's definitely been in Hawaii for quite a long time. But because of its biology, the fact that it is dioecious, which means you need two plants, it's an outcrosser, which is somewhat of an inhibition to becoming invasive, as well as even in these areas where it is readily grown or native areas, It is considered difficult to propagate, with only 1 to 5% of the seeds reported to be viable. This, of course, good news for reducing the likelihood that mate could become a problematic weed. The propagation, often done from seeds, stool cuttings also is recommended, which essentially is cutting a plant back to just a few inches above the ground, mounding soil around the plant. Then as it vigorously resprouts, the new sprouts are also going to create their own root systems. And depending on the plant species, you get more or less roots. And apparently mate is not extremely vigorous in terms of putting out those roots in that sort of stool propagation, but it is possible to do. But of course, you need a full-sized plant that you would even consider cutting almost nearly to the ground. So that's something coming up for the future, I would imagine. Mate contains caffeine, theobromine, which of course is one of the very popular chemical constituents known from cacao, and another one called theophylline, and that gives yerba mate its characteristic bitter flavor and stimulant effects. It's known to kill bacteria in the mouth. It is considered antioxidant, anti-obesity, anti-inflammatory, or at least it has those effects. It also contains lots of vitamins and lots of minerals, too. Good suitability for our soils, it seems, in that the native range are oxisols, and that is a lot of the soils we have here on Kauai. It is 5 years to harvest maturity from seed. It does prefer partial shade when young and then full sun. And I saw photos of giant plantations of mate. We're often led to believe that it's, you know, more of this artisanal collecting in the forest and imagining, you know, multi-diverse species growing and the parrots and toucans in the trees and perpetuation of indigenous or otherwise local lifestyles. And that may be true in some places, but of course it's also a major commodity crop, and massive plantations do exist as well. And so all of this is something to chew on. Would be interesting to see if anybody is having any success. An internet search for Hawaii-grown mate came up completely blank for me. So I'm wondering if some people are having any success cultivating this plant. And as we consider this, we could also consider that there is a close relative of mate that is probably even a better suit for us, the botanical name Ilex guayusa, or known as its common name of guayusa. This would be an alternative similar in qualities, also containing caffeine and stimulant qualities. This plant, native to the upper Amazonian regions of Ecuador, northeastern Peru, and southwestern Colombia. Ilex guayusa is rarely ever seen in flower and perhaps has never been seen in seed, so this meaning vegetatively propagated and extraordinarily unlikely to become weedy, which is great. And I've been growing it for some years. It's very prolific, and thanks to friends who have shared that plant around, it is also considered a sacred plant and has dream-stimulating qualities to it as well. So a really good quality holly that has stimulant properties could be a better bet than mate, but I'm sure that people will be looking into cultivating mate as well. Well, right now, we're really excited to be speaking with our special guest today. It's Ken Love. Ken is the executive director of the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers. He's adventured throughout the world, tracking down rare fruits and bringing them into our collective consciousness, as well as into our backyard gardens, farm orchards, and all the way to the finest restaurant tables and value-added product markets. Through his numerous research publications, feature films, and educational programs, Ken has ignited and fanned the flames of our passion for the exotic and delicious fruits that bring so many of us indescribable bliss. Ken will be joining us this weekend on Kauai as the local chapter of the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers readies to host the International Fruit Growers Conference this year. Ken, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's good to talk to you again.
Fantastic. Well, we're really grateful, and maybe we could start in just our heart is pouring out to you. You're facing a situation that we often face. You never know when it's going to come, but when it comes hard. And I understand you've been dealing with some major wild pig problems.
Yeah, I mean, this is in 33 years. This is the hardest that's ever come. You know, one or two here or there, and they're really brazen. I mean, I was talking to my friend Eli last night, who was helping me with some stuff, and it was dark, but you know, it was just after dusk, and we're sitting there, and I heard something, and what was that? And he thought, oh, just the cats. And I look over there, and the cat's face to face with about 150-pound black boar with just beginning double tusks. And I shouted at the boar. He just kind of oof and moved off. And he moved into the field. So I threw an empty 5-gallon bucket at him, and he just moved another 10 feet. And then Eli went one way, and I went the other way, and we started screaming before he ran off. But then this morning they broke five. I have 26 stations for irrigation. They broke five main lines and about 22 risers and emitters. So with the 5 hours of work, it's about, you know, $700-$800 worth of damage, and between the mains and all the parts. And at least they didn't bite through any valves today. We've got four valves with the teeth marks in it. But
oh,
I mean,
goodness.
These guys are fighting through the bell ends of 1-inch, you know, PVC pipes. I mean, they're really thirsty.
Wow.
We hose out for them and made mud, as much mud as you can get in Kona's rocky ground. But that didn't stop them at all. They still came in and destroyed everything. Up, and we have a really high voltage system that should be in by the end of the week.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're all feeling for you.
Every day we get this kind of damage.
No, it's frustrating too, because for all of the assistance that we get from the USDA and NRCS, for some reason, perimeter fences, which is like one of the major things in terms of expense and need, is something that we can't seem to get any support for with financial programs.
Diane Lay with the Farm Services Agency, she's been looking everywhere trying to find a way to help. But sorry to say that, but NRCS has been pretty useless when it comes to the fencing, you know, and I guess they don't have the EQIP program right now, which helped a lot of people.
Right.
If they do, they don't have it for fencing. At least, I mean, I walked in with a 1-by-2-foot box filled with broken pipes and emitters and said, okay, this is just from the last 4 days, so what can we do? And they said, we don't do anything anymore, and that's it.
Well, it's not the people, but it sure is the policies we need to change.
Yeah, exactly. I pretty much give it up and just have to go into debt for something else. I mean, we had about a 10-year-old meringue tree, which is just a great fruit relative of breadfruit and jackfruit. And this thing had like a 5-inch diameter trunk, and you just bit through it.
Oh, my goodness.
Plus, they destroyed all my kola nut trees and a bunch of fig trees and dug out some rare Eugenias from Ecuador. I mean, they've just a lot of damage that I can't get anything new done, you know, because I just spend all my time repairing stuff. And we have to get ready for a new HTFG, Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Project. We'll have 10,000 trees ready by the end of the year, although some will have to stay in quarantine until 2018. But we'll have a lot of trees that we'll be able to sell at cost because of the subsidies. Yeah, these trees will be sold to the nurseries and to individuals in larger lots to help people establish orchards, but they'll be sold at cost.
Right.
So, I mean, they'll be a tenth of what you can buy stuff for.
Fantastic. And these trees are being grown there on the Big Island.
Yeah, we're bringing some in from... we've got 1,200 citrus started, and we're grafting in a couple weeks, and then Lag was grafting mango this morning. We've got 1,000 those, 1,000, well, almost 1,000 avocados. The pigs destroyed a bunch of them. I mean, they tore through 2x4 retaining walls to get at them.
Wow, so, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's pretty nerve-wracking, too. But anyway, so, and then we're bringing in rambutan, durian, mangosteen from the Philippines, jackfruit, some Bacaria species, and black pepper from India.
Wow, so those are the plants that need to go through the quarantine process.
Well, not actually. Black pepper, when it comes in, we'll be able to sell it by the end of the year. Black pepper and Bacaria, rambai or Burmese grape or moody fruit, those are things that we can just distribute right away. Rambutan, because there's some here, durian and some of the others, they have mangosteen. They have to stay in quarantine.
Right.
But now, if you're a new farmer and you've got an orchard and you want to put in 10 acres, you can have your land approved by Hawaii Department of Ag, and we can send you some of the things, and they'll just, you can put them right in the ground. They just have to be quarantined for 2 years before you can release anything.
Right. Wow. Well, that sure is putting a kick in the pants to local fruit production, which is so exciting. And, Ken, you've done so much through time to support that effort. I know for myself personally, the step of the process, which is the exploration and discovery of new varieties or new species of fruit, is some of the most tantalizing part. And I know you've done a lot of that, and I'd love for you to share with our listeners about some of the highlights of where you've gone and what you've done and how people could follow in that model.
I have a friend who used to live here who's been in Ecuador for 30 years, Jim West. So we get a lot of material from him. And I spent a lot of time in India and in all through Japan. But some of the things we're bringing back are exclusive to India, like kokum, which is very much like mangosteen, a little more tart, so it's kind of not as cloyingly sweet as mangosteen, and much faster growing. It's endless.
Is that a Garcinia?
Yeah, Garcinia indica. Another one, Garcinia koa, which is a little yellow Garcinia that it makes absolutely the best jelly I've ever had.
So, and that really leads to that concept that it's one thing to find this strange fruit that's so exciting to botanical nerds like you and me, but it's about knowing how to then transform it into something that the more average palate or people who are maybe less adventurous are willing to actually try and discover and realize that it's delicious.
Yeah, very true. I mean, even things like durian is still a challenge for many people. But it has such potential for growers. For durian, we're bringing in over about 1,500, I hope, durian trees from the Philippines.
Wow.
And although the first durian in Hawaii was on Kauai and destroyed by Iniki, there's still, an ever-increasing number of these trees around the state. And that, for anyone who doesn't know, that's the fruit they don't allow on buses and hotels in Thailand because of the smell. They say it tastes like heaven and smells like hell, et cetera. But there's a lot of addicts out there for durian.
I have fallen in love. I would not qualify myself as an addict. I'm definitely going to get pushed aside by those who are a bit more fanatical. But after a while, it really grew on me.
Yeah, it does. And what's nice for growers here is that there's no pest risk assessment required. It's like pineapples and papaya. You can put it in a box and put it on the airplane. Mm. Not that you'd want to sit next to me on a flight to the mainland if I'm carrying a case of durian overhead, but it's legal.
Very cool.
So, yeah, and there's just such a ready market for fresh durian in L.A. I mean, there's over 2 million pounds that are shipped in frozen from Thailand to just L.A. every year. And this is a market that could be easily obtainable by Hawaiian growers.
So now some of the ones that you're bringing in from the Philippines would represent varieties?
We'll have, like 250 or 300 each of five different varieties.
Amazing. And they're not spoken for yet?
No. See, this whole thing started when a ranch on Maui called me. We need 1,000 Charwell trees. 1,000 Charwell trees? Well, let me call around. Well, I called like every nursery I could find in the state. There were 247 trees available. Eventually you need to get into this because a grafted fruit tree, let's say a 4-foot grafted fruit tree, is in Japan, which is of course supposed to be so expensive, is pocket change in comparison to what we sell a tree for.
Right.
And so our priorities are a little bit twisted around, and so we have to work to bring down the cost of this. Buy local. Everybody wants us to buy local and get rid of the imports. There's nothing left to buy. It's a seller's market. So the quality fruit that we grow in Hawaii is almost all sold. And until we get more trees in the ground, we can complain about buying local all we want to, but there's nothing to buy. But different, when everybody has avocados at the same time. Because then it may be hard at a local farmer's market, but we need cooperatives. We need people to bring those together because the big stores, they want to go ahead and buy 5,000 pounds of avocados.
Right.
Not 4 pounds from 5,000 people.
And do we have any good models here in Hawaii of growers, cooperatives like that, that are having success?
No, that's the problem, really. I mean, we have individual buyers like Adaptations over here. Who buys from a lot of the small farmers and delivers to the hotel and restaurants. I mean, some like you have Peter Merriman and some of the places on there. Even one of the, I think it's Kauai Beach Resort, they were trying to buy local stuff and they just couldn't find it. And they need, the restaurants need things on a regular basis too.
Right.
So, everybody who needs this stuff has got to go out and find, it's as much work to find the clients, but if you don't service them, they're not going to call you again. So you have to make sure you can produce what you're trying to sell.
Right.
So that's the advantage. If we have small cooperatives or small wholesalers, then they can buy little bits from a lot of farmers, as needed, and then work to gain those into something for a hotel restaurant that needs a lot more.
Well, it just makes perfect sense, and I sure hope we see those popping up in Hawaii because the small producer faces so many challenges from merely producing the crop, but then marketing is a challenge for these economies of scale that you're talking about. I want to let people know you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We're here until 1 o'clock, and we're speaking with Ken Love. He's the executive director of the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Association. Really blew my mind with that latest project of bringing in or cultivating thousands of high-quality, highly desired fruit varieties that can really make an economic difference for the growers and help us to meet our local food desires and needs, as well as even expand our exports of some of the most highly valuable crops like durian you mentioned. And
yep.
Mangosteen is another one that seems like it could be, but is there, I know it's certainly not as shippable just in terms of the hardness of the rind. I've heard varying things. I mean, it certainly has a thick rind, but does it spoil too quickly for international market?
It would be shippable by air. And it's a high value enough where shipping it by air wouldn't be a problem. It's just that it's very slow growing. And a lot of our farmers, the typical age of farmer in Hawaii happens to be my age, and it's 63. So I don't know if I'm going to plant a lot of young mangosteen, which I won't see produced for maybe until I'm 83.
Right.
Well, I won't have teeth, but I can, still swallow them. Anyway.
But we can get the young farmers excited about it, I think is
the
point.
Yeah, well, that's it. But that's another issue. So, okay, we've got all these young farmers who are excited. They can't afford to go to the big box stores to buy trees. They can't afford the land that, you know, is just priced just ridiculously high. So what do we do to enable people to go into agriculture? We have to really increase the awareness and increase the I can't even find the right word. I mean, we just have to make agriculture something that people want to do and something that's profitable. I mean, a lot of younger people from all the islands, really, they look how hard the folks and grand folks have worked, and they had no way they want to do that. You know, so how do we make agriculture a desirable and profitable? Mm-hmm. And this is something that has to be looked at long and hard. You know, mm-hmm. How do we get people to be able to afford the land?
Well, it's a huge problem, and we have at least a handful of very generous landowners that are looking for those cooperative opportunities. Perhaps more state land is coming online where long-term leases could be secured, but we're still operating under that sort of old model that unless you're cultivating more than 100 acres, you're not really a farmer. And
yep. And that's the key. In Japan, if you can apply and yet you can go to a lot of places that give you 5 acres, you farm it for 5 years, the land becomes yours. If you need, in Japan, if you need you're starting this new farm, you got a minimum of 5 acres, the government pays you about $35,000 a year salary to get started.
Wow.
In farming. Subsidized farming. Instead of giving it to these billion-dollar corporations and factory farms. These are for small farms. If you need a greenhouse on your farm, the federal government in Japan pays 50%, and the prefectural government pays, like the state government, pays 20%, and you only have to come up with 30% to get a new greenhouse. So their idea of agriculture, there's a lot for us to learn from their ideas.
Indeed. Well, hopefully we can continue the support moving in the right direction, and certainly we do have efforts at the state and federal level that are doing their best, but we need to inform them where it's coming up short or where it's actually gaining traction, and I've seen some hopeful moves in that direction in terms of the dialogue. And
we definitely have to keep talking about it and on the case.
Indeed. Indeed we do. So let's get back to the tropical fruits, Ken, because that's a real area of expertise for you par excellence. We are grateful that you are helping to lead the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Association. We have a local chapter here on Kauai. I have heard about it for years. I kind of had a conflict for a few years where I couldn't come to the meetings. But it seems like the door is opening for me, and I'm really enthusiastic to be sitting with people who share that passion, and the programs are exciting. Of course, we have the international conference that you hold every year coming to Kauai this year, which is a great opportunity for our local community to get involved. And I know that you're heading to Kauai this weekend in part to forward the discussion on that conference. And as well, there's a work day planned for Saturday, but let's focus in first
Friday
on
Friday night, too.
Oh, and Friday night as well. So, yeah, why don't you tell us what your
Friday
program
during the
is.
Day, we've got some meetings with the county, and at Kauai Beach Hotel is where the conference is going to be. And it should be really great. The resort manager of the hotel was a chef friend of mine from Kuala Lumpur 20 years ago.
Wow.
So he wound up in Kauai now, and so he's given us a really good deal and good rates on rooms for people coming in or who just want to stay there. And with two of the speakers so far, one is Chef Ernie Miller, who runs the Master Food Preservers in Los Angeles and knows the history of value-added products and foods inside and out. And I know from having taught a few classes on Kauai for the Master Food Preservers and at WIPA and other conferences that it's a really big topic for growers on Kauai. I mean, you've got all this stuff, and now what do we do with it? So Ernie's going to address a lot of that. And then Dr. Dai Yonemoto from Japan, who is known for developing his the mangoes there and pruning techniques to facilitate harvesting. He's going to come back. He was so popular up north that everybody wanted to have him come back. And
oh, that's great news.
Avocados and pruning and horticulture. He used to run the Japanese government tropical horticulture program and retired to do his own different projects. And now we're working on some avocado projects together, both here and in Japan.
Very cool. So we've had David Watmore, the vice president of Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers here in Kauai, share about that in the pruning workshops he's done, and I gather that they do some pretty radical pruning on their trees, but the production is off the charts.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, so he'll be back to do that. And I don't know if we're going to go to David's place as part of the tour. The conference is on September 30th and October 1st and 2nd. And then this Friday, I haven't decided what to talk about yet. Friday night at National Tropic Botanic Garden. So we'll have the first part of the tree, fruit tree and scion exchange sale at NTGB in the Educational Center. And because that's where our repository project is.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, and then Saturday we'll go out and plant some more at the repository project. So we had a project for State Department of Ag, a specialty crop block grant through the feds, to make 4 2-acre germplasm repositories around the state. Kona, Hilo, and Molokai, and Kauai, where the NTGB was kind enough to give us a couple of acres alongside of the new road that they built. And so we're getting in, well, when we're finished, it'll probably be about 100 rare species of fruit trees that will grow up. And with Scott Sloan, who's the chapter president, with his help, we'll be able to have events there, and you'll be able to go down as a member and be able to air layer or take cuttings from these rare trees.
Wow, wonderful.
So it's just, again, it's a matter of spreading the germplasm and protecting the germplasm so that all growers can have a couple of these different trees, because everybody is going to pick something else to develop into either a cash crop or value-added product. So I think there's some, like, one I'm working on here is called O-Ray, or Davidsonian plum. It's a rare fruit from the outback. It tastes like, if you know the Japanese pickled plums, umeboshi.
Yes.
This tastes like a natural umeboshi.
Wow.
And we had an event here. I still help out at the chefing at the Four Seasons here, and we had an event, and all the other chefs, they just went nuts for this fruit. So it's got great potential.
So, well, you've got my mouth watering. I'm sure some of the listeners are wondering, if they come to the conference or some of these meetings, what's the possibility that they'll be tasting some of these unusual or rare fruits?
There's always a tasting. The details haven't been worked out. I mean, the last time, 7-8 years ago, I think on Kauai, we had a great tasting. The whole program has evolved since then. So anyway, so that information will be available, and talk to Scott or David Watmore or Liz Ito and some of the other, John Anderson, are the active Kauai members.
Yes. The active collaborators, but I was we were lucky enough to host one of the meetings up at our food forest a couple months ago, and gosh, we had almost 40 people show up. So you've got a lot of active people here, but of course there's always those people who do 80-90% of the work. So thanks to Liz and John and Scott and David and.
But we need more, so everybody's welcome.
Indeed. So even if you're not a member, you could go to one of these member events and just become a member at the event.
Absolutely. or just experience. I mean, a lot of times when we were planting and clearing for the initial planting at NTGB for the repository, a lot of non-members came and helped, and they later became members, but, you know, they got a couple free trees for working there. So there's we bribe anybody any way we can. We'll work for trees.
Indeed. Well, the spirit of generosity shown by the plants is a good indicator of how we can be. And I think that generosity of spirit is what keeps us coming back, too.
Yeah. Well, you guys have such incredible resources on all sides of the island there, between, you know, from NTGB up to WIPA, you know, there's and the food forest and the other Malama Kauai. And it's just, incredible resources. And I think you're, after Kona and Hilo, Kauai is the largest chapter, much bigger than Oahu or Maui, for example.
All right. So, well, we're proud of that.
Yeah, and you should be.
Indeed.
And it's a credit to the people who do the work. And we keep looking for different events. We'd like to do some more tastings on Kauai. It's all, you know, where it's grant-driven, so... I keep writing grants, and if we can, get these different fruits to do tastings at farmers markets there, that would be great. And that's one of the goals for next year. Some other grants that we hope to get lucky with about bringing more durian in. One, you know how you get those big mango trees and you got to get the binoculars out? Yeah, I think there's one or two mangoes way up there. Get the binoculars. And there is, but there's no way you could ever go up and pick them.
Right.
So we want to get a grant to take those five-story trees down to, 10 feet and really find out if it's easier to cut them down or just take them out and put in new trees. What's going to produce better, quicker fruit?
Right.
So we're looking at that as a project and a number of other food and value-added products and there's more master food preserving classes.
Hmm. Well, the list goes on, and one thing we didn't really mention in detail, and we'll have to catch with you next time around, but you have produced so many great publications on tropical fruits, their utilization, their care and management. And I just hope you keep churning them out. I'm embarrassed to say I still haven't seen The Fruit Hunters, but people are like, what, are you kidding? That movie's made for you.
Well, it's on Netflix and Amazon, so it's easier.
All right. Well, I'm going to have a look for it. And, Ken, thanks so much for spending the time with us today. We're looking forward to seeing you this weekend. And, we're proud to host the international conference, and we're going to do right by you this time around.
That sounds great.
All right. Best of luck to you.
Thanks
we'll
to
talk. We'll see you this weekend.
Take care.
Aloha.
Bye.
This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio, and we're going to finish up the program today with a reading from Acres USA magazine. This is an article I've been wanting to share for a little while now, and this is a article entitled "The Biochemical Sequence of Plant Nutrition" by Hugh Lovell. Back in 1994, at an EcoFair event, I had lunch with one of America's top soil consultants, who was lecturing about the key importance of calcium in the early stages of fruit development, when cell division occurs. His metaphor was that an apple not much bigger than a prune had virtually all the calcium content it would ever have. He tested soils for calcium and applied it as needed, but unfortunately this did not guarantee that sufficient calcium got into the apple. When I asked him what he did in regard to boron, which was responsible for sap pressure, he responded, "Of course, boron is necessary for calcium uptake, and we test for it. If it is needed, we put it there, but we still can't guarantee that the calcium gets in the apple." Then I asked what he did about silicon, the basis of transport in both plants and animals. His response was, "We don't test for silicon. It's in all soils, whether sand or clay." Until then, it hadn't sunk home that although I was used to looking for visual signs of silicon in plants, I hadn't actually seen any soil or leaf tests that included it. This got me wondering, and as I investigated, I found, almost uniformly, soil and leaf testing labs did not test for silicon unless it was specifically requested. As a biodynamic grower, I knew that Rudolf Steiner, with a doctorate in math, chemistry, and biology, identified the oxides of calcium and silicon, lime and silica, as the opposite poles of life chemistry. I'd used this concept for years and years, along with Johann Bockemuhl's leaf studies from his book In Partnership with Nature, and Johann Wolfgang von Goethe's treatise The Metamorphosis of Plants as guides. Looking further, I found that in the early days of agricultural chemistry, Justus von Liebig tested both soils and plants for silicon, found it in all cases, was unable to prove it was an essential nutrient by excluding it from plant media, and thereafter dropped it from his tests. This became the norm for agricultural testing. The soil consultant, with his riddle of getting calcium into early fruit development, started me thinking about possible connections. I began to realize that there was an obvious hierarchy of how elements worked in living organisms. One thing had to occur before another thing could happen, and so on down the line in a sequence. Eventually, I developed my theory of this hierarchy of elements, calling it the biochemical sequence. Boron kicks off the biochemical sequence by activating silicon, making it an amorphous fluid and providing sap pressure. I knew that boron is used in making glass, which is amorphous fluid silica, and I found this relationship also held true for plant chemistry. Of course, sap pressure would be of no use without a transport system to contain it, and silicon provides the actual transport of nutrients. Interestingly, applying too much boron too early in a crop cycle is notable for burning seedlings and young transplants, such as sprouting squash or beans, because too much sap pressure in such a tiny plant drives sodium out the leaf margins. Nevertheless, in plants where leaf veins are highly branched, such as flowering beans, squash, and tomatoes, boron is important in later growth to maintain strong enough sap pressure to make such a complex system work. On the other hand, highly siliceous plants, silicous plants such as grasses, need less boron to give them sap pressure since their transport vessels all run parallel without branching. That's like a system of irrigation lines that only feed one sprinkler head. It doesn't take much pressure. An exception is bananas, which have a huge transport system with lots of fluid flow. They need plenty of boron to send calcium and amino acids all the way to the top of the bell stalk for cell division to occur in the bunch. Without robust transport, nowhere near as much nutrient reaches the leaves or is stored in the fruit. Chemical agriculture gets around this problem to some extent, since even with a weak transport system, anything that is highly soluble, such as potassium nitrate, is simply taken up along with water. Although nutrients are diluted, the sap flows quite easily despite low density. This is why chemically grown foods commonly have coarse, watery cell structure, as well as lower nutrition and poorer keeping quality. However, without a robust transport system, heavier nutrients such as calcium, magnesium, complex carbohydrates, and amino acids can easily be left behind. Third in the biochemical sequence is calcium. This is the last thing you want to leave behind because of its role in nitrogen fixation and amino acid chemistry. Calcium balances the electrical charges in protein chemistry and is particularly important in cell division, which is the first thing that happens in fruit or seed formation after pollination. Without it, there would be no fruit or seed. For example, in corn, calcium leaf test targets are between 0.3 and 1%, increasing as the corn approaches tasseling, with a higher target range more desirable near kernel formation. If calcium does not reach the ear in sufficient quantities, the kernels near the end of the ear simply do not fill out. With a crop such as soybeans, double or even triple the calcium values of maize are needed for full pod set without shedding pods, a common problem in soybeans. Wouldn't you like to see every kernel on your corn fill out to the end of the ear, or every soybean blossom produce a pod of beans? This only happens when boron, silicon, and calcium work together optimally. As just mentioned, whenever calcium goes, there also goes nitrogen, which is the basis of amino acid formation, protein chemistry, and DNA replication. Once nitrogen enters the picture, all sorts of proteins, enzymes, and hormones are produced, and very complex things are set in motion involving trace elements such as iron, zinc, copper, manganese, cobalt, molybdenum, and so on. Above all, there must be energy harvest or plants would never grow. Although all parts of a plant's protein chemistry require amino acid nitrogen, large amounts of amino acids go into the formation of chlorophyll, where energy is gathered. Since photosynthesis requires magnesium, it is fifth in the biochemical sequence, ahead of all the minor trace elements. Of course, photosynthesis is not simply a matter of chlorophyll catching energy. The energy has to be transferred into the production of sugars out of carbon dioxide and water, which requires phosphorus for energy transfer. Otherwise, the chlorophyll burns up and the leaves turn a wine red color. As long as there is enough phosphorus, however, carbon is pried loose from carbon dioxide so it can combine with water to make sugar and release oxygen. Then the sugars pass into the plant's sap, where potassium, the electrolyte, conducts them to wherever they most need to go. Understandably, this sequence is oversimplified. For example, sulfur is the classic catalyst in carbon organic chemistry. Without it, nothing, not even boron, would work. Also, potassium has a very close relationship with silicon, so when silicon carries calcium and amino acids to cell division sites in the plant, potassium plays the role of an electronic doorway that lets the calcium and amino acids enter the cells that are preparing to divide. If cold weather slows potassium down, or if it is in short supply, then calcium and amino acids cannot reach the cell nuclei. The DNA cannot divide, cell division fails, and the fruit falls off the plant. Sometimes entire fruit crops are lost to a couple of degrees of frost when a light spray of kelp with potassium silicate would save the day. Nevertheless, the most important thing to understand is the role of boron, silicon, and calcium in the hierarchy of plant chemistry. Growers who simply feed plants nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, or NPK, tend to short-circuit the biological processes where strong sap pressure, boron, leads to good nutrient transport, silicon. Then optimal cell division and photosynthesis can occur, calcium, nitrogen, magnesium, and phosphorus. With high plant energy, carbon and potassium, plants are able to shed enough of their sap as root exudates to feed abundant microbial mineral release, nitrogen fixation, and protozoal digestion around crop roots. Then crops enjoy rich nutrition and are truly healthy. This only works where boron, silicon, calcium, and amino acid nitrogen from steady microbial fixation and digestion are all high. If calcium and amino acids are watered down with nitrate and potassium salts, then sap pressure is impaired, cell division is hampered, photosynthesis is weaker, magnesium and phosphorus are diluted, and we're where NPK growers are today. So that reading, thanks to Hugh Lovell, The Biochemical Sequence of Plant Nutrition, out of the June 2009 issue of Acres USA magazine. You can get more information about their range of publications at acresusa.com, and you can read more about Hugh's work at his website, quantumagriculture.com. Well, that does it for our show today. We want to thank our special guest on the show, Ken Love from the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Association, and we want to remind you to tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha, and stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations.